In legislative Washington, 2 plus 2 doesn't equal 4 until the CBO says it does. And even then, well, politics, am I right? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Tuesday, the 7th day of March. Glad you could be here, as always, everybody. One hates to be the bearer of bad tidings, to be the one who tells you that much of the punditry and commentary we've been consuming low these past 24 hours might not amount to a hill of beans. The topic at hand here, of course, is the new Republican health care bill. And I say that because there are two real questions at the core of the debate we're all about to have on this thing. How many people is it going to cover? And how much is it going to cost? The people who get to figure that out haven't yet. They get to do what's known as score the healthcare bill. They're the Congressional Budget Office, the CBO. So Marketplace's Adam Allington explains how it's all going to work.
So in a nutshell, a CBO score basically assigns a dollar value to proposed legislation. Bill X will either add to the deficit or it will subtract.
It's simple in concept and complicated in practice. The basic idea is to mimic people's behavior.
Robertson Williams is a senior fellow at the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center. He says the CBO score not only tries to approximate the cost of new legislation, it also tries to predict behavioral changes.
All these different pieces fit together based on what the projected behavior of all the actors is, and that's really hard to do.
Hard to do because, for one, the CBO can't predict the future. There could be a war or maybe some outside shock to the economy.
If you have an economic boom or an economic collapse, you get a very different answer in real practice.
The CBO runs two basic scoring methodologies. Under static scoring, the size of the economy remains fixed. But Bob Bixby of the Concord Coalition says another type of scoring does factor in larger economic impacts.
Dynamic scoring says there are certain pieces of legislation that are so consequential, it would be, you know, foolish to ignore the fact that it has an effect on the overall economy.
For example, the CBO could use the dynamic model to predict whether legislation might create new revenue. But in terms of the new GOP health care plan, Bill Hoagland of the Bipartisan Policy Center says it will also be looking at more than just costs.
How many people will be covered? What will be the average premiums and things of that nature? So it's not just the cost, but it's also an analysis of the legislation.
And all of this matters, says Hoagland, because the average American needs to know that when their elected official voted on a piece of legislation, they had the best available information at the time. In Washington, I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
Don't look now, but oil drilling and fracking in America is back. That's the basic storyline out of the big annual oil industry confab happening down in Houston, Texas this week. Crude prices have recovered a good deal from a two-year bust, and rigs are getting back to work. Not in North Dakota, the sweet spot before the bust. Talking West Texas here, a formation known as the Permian Basin has resurrected itself once again. From the Sustainability Desk, Marketplace's Scott Tong has that one.
It's Renaissance number four, at least, for the Permian Basin. Drillers first pulled oil from this Texas-sized stretch of land nearly a century ago, and each new innovation has brought more up. The key is this basin has layer upon layer of energy, which began as very old, very dead plants and animals, says geologist Mark Schuster at the University of Texas.
Critters 300 million years ago died and were buried, and eventually these rocks were heated up to a point where oil could be generated.
This land rush began when oil prices rose last year, and more drill rigs raced to the Permian than a previous hotspot, the Bakken Formation in North Dakota. Why? Well, drillers and frackers figured out how to produce cheaply in the Permian, and the oil there is closer to pipelines and refineries, says Joseph Tripke of the firm Infill Thinking.
The proximity to infrastructure, labor, puts barrels coming out of the Permian at an advantage to, say, the Bakken, which is further north.
Today's Permian boom relies on fracking technology, which smaller firms developed. But now the big boys like ExxonMobil want in. Chairman and CEO Darren Woods spoke at the CERAWeek Oil Conference in Houston about investing there.
It's the size of the opportunity that we see in the Permian. It's a prolific tight oil play, and we're very pleased with the acquisition right in the heart of the Permian.
Now the fear is Permian overexuberance. Oil workers and contractors in demand are raising their prices, which could make drilling unaffordable. Happens with every boom, says consultant Joseph Tripke.
Unfortunately, we don't tend to learn from our past mistakes in this industry, from what I've seen. Every time, we overshoot.
Now there's talk of overheating and permi-inflation. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Wall Street today? Nope. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. You look at the headline numbers, this economy is doing all right. Pretty much full employment and inflation just about where the Fed wants it, if I can channel my inner Janet Yellen with you here for a second. But as we've been reporting pretty much since the recession ended, lots of people just don't feel like they have a place in this economy anymore. Arthur Brooks is the president of the conservative American Enterprise Institute. He's been writing about this in Foreign Affairs magazine recently. Arthur, it's good to have you on the program.
Thank you, Kai. Great to be with you.
Let's talk about this piece you had in Foreign Affairs. You call it The Dignity Deficit, Reclaiming Americans' Sense of Purpose. We lost it?
Yeah. Not everybody did, but there's this kind of a scary statistic for people like me who are really interested in the free enterprise system, as you are too, and our listeners, which is something like a third of the American population is starting to express pretty grave doubts in their ability to earn their success in the United States. You know, one of the things that I ask is, when I'm in front of audiences, I often ask, you know, let's just do a little thought experiment. What would happen if all of the poor people in America just disappeared? Would you know it? If all the poor people in America suddenly disappeared, I dare say that most people listening to us today literally wouldn't even know about it immediately. They have no emotional or moral connection to them.
Which is a horrible, 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 horrible thing, but probably true.
Yeah, it's probably true. And that's what it leads to is that we've gotten incredibly good at helping poor people. We could be better, of course, but we've gotten terrible at needing people. And the essence of the American experiment is that we need literally everybody in the country. And we're contravening the American experiment when we say effectively we don't need whole groups of people. It's actually un-American. You know, I'm just going to say, I'm going to guess that the Rizdals came to the United States not saying, sure is great to be in America where there's a better system of forced income redistribution. I mean, they came here because they were needed. There was something for them to do. And that's an incredibly important thing to keep in mind. This is a country that was built on the back of ambitious riffraff who are necessary. And today there's, you know, some non-trivial percentage of the population, maybe a quarter of the population, that effectively the rest of us are saying we don't need economically, socially, morally. And that's what leads to what I call the dignity gap.
I guess maybe I need you to define for me what you mean by needed, because it unless there's clarity on that, I don't know where this goes.
We have to ask ourselves, what does it mean to need another person? Is it central to the prosperity and future and security of our nation that each person be in the United States, that they exist here, that their work be taken quite seriously? And the answer clearly right now is no. And that's what leads to so much sort of shocking idleness. And there's one group in America today in particular that's having lower and lower lifespans, and it's whites 45 to 54 without a college education, especially men. Mm-hmm. And the reasons have to do with idleness. It has to do with what happens when people are idle. And there's higher cirrhosis of the liver, higher suicide, much, much higher drug overdoses that come from the fact that there's been an explosion of people in that age group that are not necessary to the workforce. So number one is making them necessary for the prosperity of the country by getting them back to work.
Which all makes sense, except for this. We have retraining programs in this economy out the wazoo, right? And yet we still have, just for instance, the 45 to 54-year-old men who can't find places. We had a story on our morning show not too long ago in which a gentleman went from retraining to retraining to retraining because the jobs kept getting either automated or shipped out from under him. What are we to do?
Well, for one thing, it doesn't mean give up on that. The main reason that people who are older wind up being displaced and permanently displaced is because we're getting less and less mobile. And Kai, this is probably going to shock you. From when you and I were kids, the percentage of American families that move from state to state in a given year has been cut in half. Mm-hmm. Literally, there's only half as much geographic mobility as there's been in the past. And so this idea of staying where you are, wanting job retraining, but not moving to where the jobs are, it's just crazy by the standards of the 1970s in the United States, yet that's standard operating procedure in the United States. So one of the things we also have to do is to get people moving more. That's a completely American thing. My own family moved West every generation like one step ahead of the law, basically. And that was just, you know, man, that was just the way things worked. And now the concept that we got to stay in a town even when we don't have any work, simply because the family is there or that's where we've always lived. I mean, that's sort of anathema to the American experience.
As a guy who thinks about this on a more consistent and long-term basis than just, for instance, me who's wrapped in a daily news cycle, are you optimistic that these changes you are calling for and that you clearly say we need as an economy, are you confident that they can happen?
I actually am, because we can renew our society, and this typically happened every, you know, few decades in the United States, where there's this kind of frontier spirit that overtakes the country, where people start taking their future into their own hands and public policymakers start to play along. Now here's the interesting thing, Kai. I mean, I would like to see aspirational leadership that's responsible for it, but typically what happens is that there's a kind of that pioneer spirit comes from the grassroots up, and then politicians get out in front of it. So what we need is a cultural change where Americans start expecting that of themselves. It has, in fact, happened. It happened at, you know, various junctures in American history where Americans moved around a lot more. Americans became a lot more entrepreneurial. And if we can maybe right, you know, today on Marketplace, we can stimulate a new cultural revolution in American mobility.
Arthur Brooks is the president of the American Enterprise Institute. His piece is in Foreign Affairs this month. It's called The Dignity Deficit, Reclaiming American's Sense of Purpose. Arthur, thanks a lot. Good to talk to you.
Thanks, Kai.
Tomorrow is, according to the United Nations, International Women's Day. It's also, according to organizers of the January Women's Marches, the day after Inauguration Day, a day without a woman. They're asking women to stay home from work to underscore the economic contribution they make. It's unclear at the moment how many people are going to participate, although a few school districts are getting some attention for their planned closures. Marketplace's Annie Baxter has more on that.
Officials at Chapel Hill Carrboro City Schools in North Carolina learned last week that as many as 400 staff, teachers, bus drivers, and nutritionists, would likely be out March 8th. Spokesman Jeff Nash says that's a 20% absentee rate.
And we knew that we didn't have enough substitutes and people to fill those roles.
So they announced they'd close schools tomorrow, giving parents time to plan. Nash stresses it isn't a political statement.
This was about us being entrusted with the care of 12,000 students who are given to us every day.
Women make up nearly half the U.S. workforce. Organizers of the protest want women to skip work and only patronize women in minority-owned businesses. The National Retail Federation says the potential effects are unclear. Ditto for the National Restaurant Association. Spokeswoman Leslie Shedd says the trade group encourages freedom of speech, but asks that workers at restaurants, many of which are small businesses, come to work tomorrow.
You know, if these small businesses have much needed employees not show up, you know, that can have a really big detriment on our restaurants.
She says about a third of restaurants are women owned. Critics say the protest will mostly involve women who can afford to skip a day of work. Joy Cook thinks that's unfair. She's president of a public relations firm that did work for the Women's March in January. She'll stay home tomorrow because she says others can't.
So that is why it's even more important as me as, you know, a self-employed, single black female to do that, to make a stand.
She says her 7 employees will also stay home. I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
Coming up.
I'm not looking to see a full-scale assault of any kind on the Trump movement.
Tricky times for network television. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials was off 29 points on this Tuesday, a 10th percent, closed at 20,924. The NASDAQ off 15 points, about a quarter percent, 5833. The S&P 500 down 6 points, 3/10 percent, 2368. Drug makers dropped today after President Trump said he's working on ways to bring down prescription drug prices. Eli Lilly wilted 1.3%. Pfizer slipped 1%. Merck
down about 0.75%. Tech stocks rallied, though. Texas Instruments played up 1%. Data storage firm Nimble Storage jumped 46.25% after agreeing to be bought by Hewlett-Packard Enterprise for about $1 billion. Microsoft firmed up about 0.2% today. Dick's Sporting Goods kicked up 8.6% after the sportswear chain posted better-than-expected results and beat analysts' expectations to boot. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.51%. You're listening to Marketplace. Hi, it's Kai Rizdahl.
And I'm Molly Wood.
If you want to get smarter about the things we talk about on Marketplace every day,
technology, the economy, culture, check out our weekly podcast, Make Me Smart. It's a chance to tell us the things you really want to learn more about and share with us the things you know more about than anyone else.
We're at marketplace.org/makemesmart or wherever you get your podcasts, and follow us on Twitter for updates. I'm at Kai Rizdahl. Molly is at Molly Wood. Check it out.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. A couple of three, 4 years ago, I went out to Sioux Falls, South Dakota, as part of a series we were doing with Jim Fallows of the Atlantic magazine, American Futures, if you remember that. I met a guy there named Kurt Laudenbach. He and his wife run a company called Grand Prairie Foods. They make, among other things, microwavable sandwiches and those scrambled eggs that you see in a lot of hotel breakfast buffets across the country. We've called them up because, A, it's always a good idea to check back in with people, but B, given the election and what's been going on since then, we've got a couple of questions to run by him. Curtis, good to talk to you again.
Yeah, Kai, good to hear from you as well.
We were out in Sioux Falls, gosh, almost 4 years ago now, I guess, with Jim Fallows. Things were going well for you. You were looking for growth. How's it been the past 3 years?
Well, it's been really good for us. In fact, it prompted me to look back and see where we were with our business at that point in time. And I'm proud to say that we have doubled our business
wow.
since then. And have actually just about doubled our workforce as well. So things have been good for Grand Prairie Foods.
Well, since you mentioned the workforce, that's kind of the real reason we called, because as I remember from being out there with you, the workforce in Sioux Falls, and yours specifically, is really heavily immigrant-based, right? I mean, you need a flow of immigrants to get your products out.
We do. In fact, we have about 175 total employees today, and of that, roughly 120 of them are either immigrants or refugees.
So what are you looking at when you see the current political environment and the word coming out of the White House?
Well, I have to tell you that we're somewhat concerned about that, because immigrant and refugee labor are folks that are interested in a new life, and they're interested in entry-level positions, not only in our type of business, but in many, many businesses across the country. And so I have to say we're a little bit concerned about some of the rhetoric that we hear relative to those sources of labor. It seems like there's an environment of more restriction, and we're kind of cautious about that at this point in time.
So what's the plan? Because a limitation, a constraint on immigration, legal immigration to this country with refugees and others, is literally a constraint on your business growth.
I would have to say that it potentially will be. We're keeping an eye on the environment. We watch it closely. We're starting to talk about what potential alternatives will there be if we're not able to find the labor that we need to continue to grow our business. And in most cases, that means automation.
Yeah, but I'll tell you what, I remember actually, I have vivid memories of going to your plant in Sioux Falls, and it was great loads of frozen scrambled eggs, right, that have to get put into cartons and containers. Is that automatable work?
Some of the work is not automatable. A part of our business that has grown substantially is a sandwich building for the food service world. And that's a very manual process. It's difficult to automate putting a piece of sausage on a sandwich.
Yeah, I can't quite conceive of how that would work, actually.
You know, there are companies that are trying, but yeah. So far the technology that we have seen is very expensive, and we're concerned about how reliable it may be.
Give me the bigger picture in Sioux Falls and in sort of that part of the country. How are folks feeling about the macro economy?
I would say people feel pretty good about it. We've done well for many, many years, as you noted. And I think at that point in time, when you were here in 2013, the area unemployment rate was in the 4 to 4.5% range, which was well below the national average. And today we're in the 2 to 2.5% range. Hmm. So the economy continues to grow. There's been lots of investment. And so I would say that people in South Dakota feel good about the current economic environment.
Curtin Loudenbeck is the CEO and president of Grand Prairie Foods. We talked to him a couple of years ago out in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. Curt, thanks very much.
Thank you for your time.
A couple of very notable exceptions over the past 40 or 50 years. Primetime network comedies usually try to stay in pretty safe territory because with 30-second ads selling for around $100,000, makes sense, right? Offending advertisers can be expensive. But what happens to a show that was slightly edgy to start with, what happens to it when the politics of the moment change, when social and cultural shifts and events make it relevant in ways that maybe nobody expected? Marketplace's Adrian Hill has that story.
The Real O'Neills is, in many ways, a par for the course network comedy.
It's a family comedy that centers on an Irish Catholic family in Chicago.
That's Casey Johnson, one of the show's executive producers. In the pilot episode,
this perfect veneer of a family crashes in a night. And it's just a story about the aftermath of all of that and how this family kind of comes together.
Toss in a few musical numbers, and you have a not unfamiliar formula. But The Real O'Neills, which is finishing up its second season this month on ABC, is different in one big way. At its heart, it's about a teenage boy coming out.
I finally have a boyfriend. It's gonna last forever.
Aw, so cute.
Well, it hadn't been done before. ABC has this incredible tradition of family comedies, but they hadn't done it about a gay teenager.
During the first season of the show, national politics lined up with the show's message of acceptance. She says the writers celebrated the Supreme Court ruling on same-sex marriage, rainbow cake and all. But during the second season, those politics have changed. The Republican Party has traditionally been less friendly to the LGBTQ community. President Trump recently reversed an Obama policy that allowed transgender students to use the bathroom of their choice. Some Republican lawmakers are actively hostile toward gay rights. And that shift has cast the show in a new light.
Initially, we were scared that, oh God, maybe people are going to run away from it. I think some of us still feel that way.
David Windsor is also an executive producer on The Real O'Neills.
Personally, I feel that the show is more relevant now than ever.
But relevance is tricky for network comedies, especially political relevance in moments of big cultural change. Rewind to the 1960s, the counterculture movement, Vietnam.
Largely, television avoided confronting it.
That's David Bushman from the Paley Center for Media. He says networks were making plenty of money, running shows like Green Acres and the Beverly Hillbillies.
Listen to my story about a man named Jed.
The Mod Squad had hippies, but the hippies were actually cops.
Those things were okay, but basically you didn't want to go too near the heart of the issues that were divisive, because A, you'd be turning off a good part of your audience. B, you'd be turning off advertisers.
Over time, says Bushman, scripted primetime comedies became more relevant. From All in the Family back in the 70s.
Those were the days.
To Blackish today.
Okay, so I'm just your standard, regular old, incredibly handsome, unbelievably charismatic black dude.
But Bushman says those same business calculations still apply.
But I'm not looking to see a full-scale assault of any kind on the Trump movement in primetime network television. I would be shocked if we did.
Which brings us back to The Real O'Neills, how to make sense of its newfound relevance, its political relevance. At the same time, it stays true to what it is, a comedy meant for everyone. Here's Windsor again, one of the executive producers for the show.
For us, from the beginning, and it continues to be true, we've always wanted it to be a conversation.
But whether that's a conversation ABC thinks its audience wants to keep having, we'll know that later this spring, when it announces plans to cancel or renew The Real O'Neills. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, Nike's got a new item. It's the Nike Pro Hijab, a performance head covering for female athletes. Stretch fabric, adjustable elastic to keep it on longer in back so it won't come untucked when she moves around. Also, because branding is everything, the Nike swoosh featured prominently above the left ear. All right, we're done. We got to go. The Dow off 29 points, about a 10% today. The Nasdaq down 15 points, a 0.25%. S&P 500 off 6 points, about 0.3%. Tommy Andres and Raghu Manavalan are the producers on our special projects desk. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our wealth and poverty desk. Our digital team includes Ben Hethcote, Sarah Menendez, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.